You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 176.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. Really fun interview today. But first of all, let me just follow up on the predictions panel that we did last week. A lot of great feedback from all of the predictions we did, but I do want to do some kind of follow-up in the future because there were actually a lot of past predictions that we made from 5 years ago to today that I feel like I need to dive into more because there's a lot of lessons to be learned from it, particularly on crypto, on the behavior of big tech, things that we said 5 years ago that did happen. So I'd like to talk about that. Currently, I'm having kind of a big travel weekend. I was just in Long Island for a family event. A lot of fun. It was just great to be going back to family events and things like that. And then I'm going back into New York City today for work, for Foursquare work. So that's going to be great as well. And then finally, I'm going to return to New Hampshire in the middle of this week. So our guest today, Gene Epstein, he is a resident of New York City, but I actually interviewed him in New Hampshire when he was up visiting in New Hampshire. He's a really fun person to talk to. He is a longtime economics editor at Barron's Magazine. But, you know, the reason that I know him is that for the last few years, he's run a debate series called the Soho Forum, which has a lot of interesting, and of course, as the name suggests, it most of the time happens in Soho, but you know, now it happens all over the place. And he has a penchant for arguing capitalism versus socialism. He's done three debates where he represents the pro-capitalism side. And as many of you know who listen to this, I like capitalism a lot. I'm a big pro-capitalism guy. So those debates are fun to listen to, and it was great to have him on. He's also been on a lot of podcasts before and is not new to the podcast circuit, so I knew it was going to be a really fascinating, fun discussion, and it certainly was, because we got a lot of kind of behind-the-scenes stuff in terms of, you know, what happens if everyone doesn't follow the rules of the debate, and what are some of the issues that have come up, and what are some of the interesting things that, because they don't just debate capitalism versus socialism, they all sorts of interesting, you know, kind of topics. So anyway, without further ado, let's welcome our guest today. Gene Epstein, you've reached the Local Maximum. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Max. And I'm certainly in a great mood. My wife and I drove up to the Free State. We're staying in Dover on Thursday. And yesterday evening, I was in the hot seat with a lot of Free Staters at the Shell. And they watched my recent debate on socialism and critiqued it afterwards. I learned a lot. I hope I taught a few people a few things, but mainly being in the company of so many like-minded people could put anybody in a great mood. And so I'm happy to be with you this morning.
That's awesome. You know, I'm in a good mood too, because first of all, I am just starting to get people to do this in person again, which is so much more fun. Mm-hmm. I feel like on Zoom, sometimes you can only get someone on Zoom. That's okay. But I have trouble paying attention. I don't know. I don't know why that is, but I'm so glad to have you here. Yeah. I'm used to seeing you on stage in the Soho Forum with like, you know, big crowds and you're kind of, you know, untouchable or whatever, but to be here like in a living room in Dover, it's pretty cool. So I'm glad you came up here.
Well, and, you know, I tolerate a lot of interviews on podcast, usually, of course, through Zoom, because people are often long distances away from me, from California and elsewhere. But I feel the same way being with you on a couch facing you. And we had at the Soho Forum to go through Zoom to do our debates over the most of the last year. And I am indeed suffering from Zoom fatigue.
Yeah.
And looking forward to in-person debates.
Yeah, those were so much fun. Like, you have the energy of the room. There is something that can't be that can't be, like, if you attend a webinar or a debate or whatever, and it's just on Zoom, it almost feels like you know, there's my work sitting right there, and there's the kitchen is in the back, needs to be cleaned, and it feels like all your problems are still there.
Sure. And the Soul Forum has had a twofold mission.
Yeah.
It's not just to host debates of interest to libertarians, one-on-one debates of interest to libertarians, but also to have a party, to have a communal experience.
Yeah.
And of course, on top of that, as you say, it's a theatrical evening, and theater belongs in a live audience.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you've been doing the Soho Forum for how long? Like 5 years? I'm trying to remember.
I've got to crunch the numbers. Started in September of 2016, which I guess now is going on 5 years.
Yeah.
And I had the idea because I felt that so many of the debates that were taking place were flawed in their concept. I wanted to do one-on-one debates, one versus one. I felt that the standard way in which these many debates were being conducted, where it was usually two against two, the model usually doesn't work because
it's more like a panel.
Well, it's like a panel, and of course, just in terms of incentives. To begin with, often it was just a politician teamed up with an academician. They didn't speak or confer beforehand, so they're not really coordinated. And then nobody has to really take responsibility for the argument he's assuming. Too many sound bites because each person gets only 6 minutes to talk. So indeed, with the one-on-one debate, it means that if I'm debating you, you are responsible for the argument. Nobody else is going to help you. And so you know you've got to take on the full burden. And so that's, I think, motivates you to do your best. So that's why I wanted to do one-on-one debates.
I'll tell you a secret. I've been doing podcast stuff for the last 3 years, but I've done a lot of public speaking before that, tech talks and whatever. Mm. I've never done a debate. Uh-huh. Even when I was an undergrad at Yale, I went to the political union debates. I saw them. I've never participated. Oh. And so I think it's like, you know, it's got to be a totally different experience, like actually being like, well, no one's going to help you, or like here at an interview, if I screw up, presumably you're going to help me, maybe. I don't know. But,
well,
you know.
No, indeed. No, of course. Tom Woods, my mutual friend and yours, when he assures people about their stage fright when they deliver a talk, as he puts it, everybody in the audience is pulling for you. So just recognize that they all want you to do well. So don't be nervous. So I told Tom, yes, everybody in the audience is pulling for you, except if you're doing a debate. And certainly if you're doing a Soul Forum debate. Because half the people in the audience, maybe more than half, have their knives out for you. And not only that, there's somebody on stage opposite you who wants to contradict almost everything you say. So indeed, a debate is a very stressful activity. I've experienced the stress now, I guess, 6 times. I've done 6 debates at the Soul Forum. We've done more than 50 debates. I should say to you podcast listeners, you should put the Soho Forum debates podcast on your podcast list. The Soho Forum debates podcast.
Do.
You'll find over 50 debates.
That'll also go on the show notes page here. Which we do have.
Oh, that's good. Yes, no, not everybody does. But we've had over 50 debates, and if you leaf through them, I think you'll find a lot of people you like. Brian Kaplan, for example, who's certainly a fellow traveling libertarian whom I greatly admire. He's participated in 3 debates that we've run. I've done 6. So I think if you go over the list, you'll like a lot of our debates. But getting back to what you just said, indeed, I've experienced the stress of going into a debate. And on top of that, it's a theatrical evening in that we do Oxford-style voting before and after vote. You vote yes, no, or undecided on the resolution before the debate begins. And then it's recorded on our app. And then you have to vote a second time, yes, no, or undecided on the resolution after the debate ends. So we declare a quote-unquote winner, which gives the evening a little bit of a conclusion. It's
right.
Obviously not decisive. You don't necessarily have to agree with the vote, but oftentimes it does. I myself have found that for the most part, I tend to agree with the vote about who won, who outpointed the other on the debate.
Yeah. I feel like, though, like if I were one of the debaters, I wouldn't want to think too hard about the actual vote, because that would just, I would think about, let me get my points out, and people will think about it in the long run.
Well, yes. You know? Although, let me add that that part of the reason why I've been successful in doing debates, I have to say that what I guess I've done, I know, six, now I'm losing track, six or seven debates. I lost one of the debates and I've won the others. The one I lost, we could discuss. I think I know why I lost. I was debating Steve Moore, who had just come from the from the Trump White House, and he was speaking with the authority of Trump. And I think that that there's certain opportunities that I didn't take because I thought I had him on the ropes.
What was the resolution on that one?
It had to do with Trump's tariff policy toward China. And the fact of the matter is that it was absurd on every level because the truth is that...
Oh, wait, I think I was there.
Oh, my God. You voted against me.
I don't remember who I voted.
I gained a lot of votes from the before and after, but to my astonishment, Steve Moore gained more. But what happened was this. The position that Steve Moore was taking defending Trump, he'd just spoken to Trump that morning, and he's speaking with great authority about the president and all the rest of it. The fact of the matter is that I was citing data and research that was so quoted in the Wall Street Journal that Trump's that even the basic wonkish argument against China was completely absurd. The truth is that we are the major offender in terms of WTO World Trade Organization rules. Just on the simply most wonkish level, we are the ones who violate what we claim China violates. We misbehave far more. But so I mix that argument with a more libertarian argument, pointing out that the Trump administration had no right to interfere in any case in my right to buy from the Chinese, and that if there was some overwhelming argument, fine, but there was no such argument. So I mixed both arguments, and I found that Steve Moore kept giving ground, and in my conclusion, I didn't talk enough about the basic wonkish fact that Steve Moore was representing a totally fraudulent position. And so I think that what happened was that that point was lost, and so a lot of people thought, well, he's representing the White House. There must be something to this. So I guess that's why I lost. But anyway, but that aside, I wanted to mention
there could have been some partisan like feelings too.
Yes,
I don't know.
Partisan. Yeah. There must have been. So, look, we attract a certainly diverse crowd. Many of the people in the audience might have been Trumpites, Trump supporters. MAGA people, Make America Great Again people. So, in any case, I was a little miffed that I lost against Steve Moore of all people. But the point.
Nobody likes to lose. But if you debate, you said seven times.
I'm six for seven.
You think you're going to win every time?
No, exactly. And
otherwise, people will say it's rigged.
Exactly. That's what my stepson JJ said. It's good that you lost once because now everybody knows it's not rigged. But the key I should mention, going back to what you said about putting forth your best arguments, which is of course right. You're not going to focus on whether you win or lose. You're basically there to make the best case you can. But bear one thing in mind, that you need to prepare in a particular way. You need to familiarize yourself thoroughly with what the opposition has said and written about the topic. There was a debate that, and I'll mention him actually, Ben Powell, who's a professor at Texas Tech, who's written a lot of good stuff about immigration. He debated, now I'm forgetting the name of his opponent, but he did not read his opponent's book on immigration. He wasn't familiar with his opponent's arguments, and so he made some good arguments, but he wasn't, in the limited time available, able to pinpoint and specify where he thought his opponent went wrong. So his arguments were blunted too often, and he lost by a couple of points. So my point is that it's not just that you need to make your best argument. You need, as I did in my socialism debate recently with Ben Burgess, Ben Burgess had published a few things, not a book, but at least published articles. I read them thoroughly, and then I subjected myself, it was a little bit painful, to listening to him, especially in his debate with David Friedman, where certain facts came out about his real position on socialism, so that I knew precisely what he thought, and I could bring that to light. And so you have to do that particular homework, subject yourself to what, and I say subject yourself because sometimes it's a little painful to do so, to what your opponent has written and said about the issue, going into the debate, so that it's like being a lawyer. You don't want to be surprised by anything. Mm. Hopefully not surprised by anything. Although, of course, you always will be a little bit surprised, but you want to minimize that. That's the key to preparation. Familiarize yourself as best you can thoroughly with what your opponent has said about the issue and written about it. Yeah.
So you must get like a lot of proposals for, we should have a debate on this, we should have a debate on that.
Yeah.
How do you... Yeah. Which proposals end up on the proverbial cutting room floor? How do you determine? How do you say, "Oh, you know what? This is going to be a good one."
Whatever grabs me in the tuchus. I'm kidding. Yeah, no, really. We did a debate on abortion, for example. I thought this woman had a good argument. I had a woman who was against abortion and had Walter Block, who was, well, that simplifies things about the
Walter
abortion.
Block's always a fun one.
He's always fun. Yeah, no, I've had Walter twice. Walter is the only one who I allowed to violate the basic principle that we don't allow character assassination in our debates. If somebody if you start assassinating the other person's character and it gets a little bit too serious, will step in and say, look, character assassination is not allowed. It's not a logical argument. Your opponent may be a reprobate and a depraved human being, but we're here to listen to the argument. Is there an issue here with the recording?
No, I'm just looking.
Okay, fine.
I'm just keeping a straight eye on it just to make sure there's no problem.
Walter Block debated Nick Gillespie of Reason on whether to vote for Trump. Just prior to the election of in which Trump won the first election.
The first one.
Yeah, just prior to November of 2016, I knew that there was an issue between them because Walter had been accused by the New York Times of being pro-slavery, and I actually said in my initial introduction that to accuse Walter of being pro-slavery is like accusing the Pope of being an atheist. And so I thought I'd cleared that dex from that absurd accusation. Walter had felt that Nick Gillespie, in his own writings, had not absolved Walter sufficiently of this accusation. So Walter, being very prickly, and Walter, a guy whom I love and admire greatly, I should say, had sued the New York Times. He was really just a little bit nuts on the subject. So in his conclusion and summary, he called Nick a depraved human being. And so I allowed that because it was just kind of funny. But so we've had different problems.
Yeah, that was a little bit strange as someone who came to the debate.
Yeah.
Like, it was an entertaining debate. Learn something, but then like when they started going after it just personally, it's like, yeah, there's some bad blood here. I don't even know what it is. And honestly, I don't care.
Well, that's great. Well, you took the right attitude, and that was Walter's failing because Nick tried to shake hands with Walter, and Walter refused to shake hands with. And again, I'm criticizing Walter and holding him up for ridicule. I mean, for example, here he is, a libertarian who does not believe in the libel laws. The vast majority of us libertarians do not believe in the libel and defamation laws. There are a few who do, I gather, but I think they're absurd. I agree with Murray Rothbard that, you can't own people's minds. Their opinion of you is their opinion of you. And as a practical matter, most of the cases that are brought by powerful people against weaker people. It's very rare that you and I are defamed by the New York Times and we can't strike back because we're so obscure. All those stories that really aren't even empirically valid. And here Walter is, a rock-ribbed libertarian, suing the New York Times for libel. And then he settles with them for money, and the New York Times apparently got Walter to agree not to reveal the nature of their settlement. So he didn't even get any intellectual truth out there. And Walter's rationale was that the New York Times is backed by the government, so he's suing the government. Why am I knocking Walter? Walter is a great and funny guy, and he's got such a lively mind. He's written on such a whole range of issues, very imaginatively. I think he's a great guy to have at the Soho Forum, and I'm very fond of him personally.
Yeah, this was maybe before the Soho Forum, I think when people ask me the first one I went to, I talk about the Hamilton debate with Tom Woods.
Yeah, that's right.
Michael Malice.
The backstory is that. That was a fun
internal debate, and I learned a ton from that one. I feel like I learned.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that there are the backstory on that to get to your point about is that I was managing the events for a monthly series called Junto, Junto named after Ben Franklin's Junto, financed by a philanthropist named Vic Niederhofer, and so I wanted to make it host debates.
I feel like he's from my hometown of Weston.
I'm sorry, what?
Sure. I feel like Niederhofer is from Weston, where I grew up. I'm not sure.
Maybe. Yeah, well.
But
yeah,
anyway,
yeah,
go
no,
ahead.
No, I think you're right.
Yeah,
he certainly has lived in Connecticut. Anyway, okay. So I was doing that, and then usually it was just an interview I did or a speaker. But then I decided to do some debates. Vic didn't like the debates, but he gave me pretty much of a free hand, and so I had Michael Malice debate Tom Woods on the issue of Hamilton being a supporter or a hero, of liberty. I think it was basically that. Now that's a perfect example, I think, of a debate where it's a little bit too semantic to really make up your mind. It depends on when the words that are used are too open to different kinds of definitions to truly be the kind of objective debate you might want, as in the case of where I debated Steve Moore on Trump's cockamamie actions against China. But the point is that kind of debate, where you might end up agreeing with both sides, where in a way it's subjective as to where you come out, it still could be fun, it still can be informative, that kind of debate, where the words that are being used are a little bit too squishy for you to really make up your mind and really decide who's right and who's wrong.
Yeah,
but it was still fun.
Well, no, I like that the debaters liked each other. Yeah, the two things I remember were, so this is like 2015, maybe 2016.
Yes, yeah.
So Michael Malice spent half of his intro basically putting up Trump tweets that weren't real Trump tweets, but like they were photoshopped, and being like, "Tom Woods, what a loser!" You know, on the like it was tweets that he wrote as Trump, and then but I feel like, you know, you got into more of the nuances towards the end. Well, what did Madison believe that was different from Hamilton?
Yeah.
And how is Madison different from Adams or Jefferson? You know, and it's like, oh, okay, actually, this is really interesting stuff.
Yeah. Well, right. So to some degree, it's kind of a makeshift kind of conflict, but where if you're interested in the topic itself, you can learn a few things. It can be entertaining. So indeed, I'm all for that kind of debate. And when, for example, I had a Walter debate of the abortion issue, there too, it's inevitable that that reasonable people can disagree about the issue, and that it's subject to too much interpretation to really be an issue that you can resolve at the end of the day. As in the case of my socialism versus capitalism, we have to be a lunatic to walk away thinking that socialism is still preferable to capitalism.
Most people in New York, well, I don't know if most people think about socialism versus capitalism, but I feel like, I feel like I'm in the minority being pro-capitalist in tech, at least. Well, I don't know. It's odd. You know, there's kind of the corporate liberal capitalist version, the moderate Democrat that might be in charge of a lot of these companies but I don't know. They haven't really had their opinions hashed out as much as we have, for example.
Yeah. Well, I think part of the problem is that the socialists are often used to just critiquing and attacking capitalism and never really being forced to come forward to talk about what they propose as an alternative. And, you know, as we economists say, you know, one of the key questions is always compared to what? You know, life is, as Thomas Sowell, a genius I greatly admire, the economist Thomas Sowell, said that there really are no solutions with respect to social and economic issues. There are only trade-offs. And, of course, if there are trade-offs, that means that one thing can be much better than the other, but it does consist of trade-offs, not true solutions, because in the social world, nothing can truly be solved. There will always be problems in whatever situation you set up. But in the case of the socialists, they don't often come forward. Capitalism is put on trial and indicted and is compared just vaguely with some sort of notion that we could all love each other and get along fine. And isn't it very nasty that bosses sometimes bawl out employees or that people get fired or whatever else? That's all very nasty, and therefore capitalism is condemned. But in my debates with socialists, I have them.
And you've done three.
I've done three.
So
yeah.
That's I'm interested in why you keep well, coming back to them.
it was just a kind of a comedy. It's just one thing led to another. What happened initially was that I found that the debates that were being conducted about capitalism versus socialism were of the sort that I mentioned. Last night, for example, I quoted, when I spoke before the Free Staters about my debate, I quoted Joseph Schumpeter, the great economist, who said, and I'll quote him again, "Capitalism stands its trial before judges who have the sentence of death in their pockets. They're going to pass it, whatever defense they hear. The only success victorious defense can possibly produce is a change in the indictment." And that's, of course, what you're talking about in New York. Just put capitalism on trial and compare it with some sort of vague utopia, and capitalism is going to be put to death. And so what happened was that a number of years ago, when was it, 2015, 2016, the Jacobins, as they call themselves, they are a bunch of socialists, they publish Jacobin magazine, challenged a couple of people at Reason to a debate about capitalism versus socialism. It was held in a large hall in New York City, with Bhaskar Sunkara being one of the debaters, and on the socialist side, and Vivek Chibber, a professor at NYU, a much older guy, being the other debater. And again, capitalism was put on trial. There was they defined capitalism in their own cockamamie way, and they didn't define socialism. No need to define socialism, because after all, we've got capitalism. So let's evaluate capitalism. Again, this was before capitalism's hanging judges. What do you guys want to put forward as an alternative? How would that work? Do you really imagine that capitalism in its practical manifestation is going to be perfect? Do you think it's going to just produce a heaven on earth? Of course not. But what is the alternative? What do you want to put in its place? They were never asked to do so. All they did, Vivek Chibber, who's a professor of sociology, he just groused that, what do you say? He said, you're forced to work under capitalism. You have no alternative but to work. You know, and I wanted the other side to say, Vivek, what, nobody's going to work under socialism? We're all just going to sit home? We'll starve if we don't work. So you're indicting capitalism because you have to. So therefore, I think I was running the Soul Forum at the time, that I've got to correct this ridiculous trend. I've got to set up a debate in which the other side is forced to come forward with what they want as an alternative. And so I actually initially invited Vivek Chibber, who's a professor at NYU, who's really close by, to appear. And I actually doubled the honorarium once he initially said no, but he kept saying no. So then I challenged Bhaskar Sunkara. And I had read Bhaskar's article about what he wanted for socialism. How would socialism transform society? He would basically take out of the free market everything, all the capital allocations, all the labor allocations would be run by the government.
So I couldn't be an investor in companies if I wanted buy up. Well, apparently he's going to want us to stop buying up cryptocurrencies, but I don't know how he's going to do that.
Yeah. But you can keep your Kenny Loggins records. Yeah. That was his article. Can you keep your Kenny Loggins records? You can keep your personal effects. You know, they keep making this book.
Keep my toothbrush.
Keep your toothbrush and keep your, and you, maybe if you can keep your car. But anyway, I think you can keep your car. But anyway, so then.
But I can't Uber.
What?
I can't use it for I can't use it for Uber.
Well, Uber will never exist because it would have to apply for financing from the government, and you're not going to undermine the taxi cartel. I mean, you know, I mean, it was all clearly just a ridiculous idea. I lost my temper with Bhaskar. I think I misbehaved. It was stupid of what I did.
I remember that, Gene. Yeah. I was there.
Yeah, and that was a dumb idea for me to lose my temper with, because he was clearly so obviously on the ropes. But when he got up there and he said, "Well, profits," I said, "Learn some economics, Bhaskar." And so I misbehaved as a debater. But I beat him in terms of Oscar-style voting. But then I thought, well, I better make amends for this and keep my cool the next time around. So I decided I'll debate a Graeminence. That was Richard Wolff. And did you attend that one?
No, I wasn't at that one.
Well, Richard Wolff.
I couldn't go to all of them.
Richard Wolff had written a major book on socialism, and called Democracy.
I bet you had to read the whole thing.
I read the whole thing, and so I summarized his book, and then I found that when he got up to respond, because he initially took the affirmative. I always take the negative. All of the debates I've done, I've taken the negative, so he got up and made his case, but then I quoted his book. What he wanted, again, the same old story, and then he got up and he said that he'd forgotten what he'd written in his book. A book is like a child. So he didn't exactly put up much of a fight, because he was no longer defending his book. So he started to speak vaguely about this and that, and again, I had him on the ropes, but it was a little bit too easy. Although I kept saying to people afterwards when I was interviewed about the debate, I said, look, Richard Wolff is the ultimate. He's the Graeminence of socialism. He's been called by the New York Times as our most important Marxist economist in the country. So if I beat him, isn't that an end to it? Well, I felt maybe not, because he had been so passive. And so that's when I decided, well, I'll do a third one against what's his name?
Ben Burgess.
Ben Burgess.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that was recently. And Ben Burgess at least put up the biggest fight of all. But then again, I was able to tease out not just that Ben Burgess wants the government to take over all of finance, 98% of finance anyway. He'll leave crowdfunding to a few bucks to crowdfunding.
Yeah.
But
that was an interesting one, because you kept saying, well, he won't allow Kickstarter. And he's like, no, yes, I will. Then you make the point, well, okay, if it's the only one that's allowed, then it becomes... a trillion-dollar industry, they might start having second thoughts about that. The argument is a few steps. It's hard to...
Well, thank you. Yeah, exactly. I did make that point, and thanks for remembering that. Indeed, I had just forgotten. He got up and he said, he debated my friend Bhaskar, and Bhaskar told him, no, he would allow Kickstarter. And Gene... that was a mistake on my part. I didn't realize that they would allow this few bucks. But then, as you said, I responded and said, if that's the only alternative, Kickstarter would probably be worth $5 trillion, because we'd all say, well, that's the loophole, we can invest through Kickstarter. But because I could have further added what Ben Burgess revealed when he was debating David Friedman, that Ben Burgess not only wants the government to dominate virtually all of finance, 98% of finance, and finance only worker-owned companies, but he wants to outlaw wage and salary employment. And so again, that just really got ridiculous. We discussed it, of course, last night. I could have perhaps put a finer point on the fact that we're talking about 140 million people, nearly 90% of the workforce that works as wages and salary workers. And many of us would want out. Many of us would want to just sign on as a wage and salary worker. He clearly will have to jail a lot of us. So that really got brutal, what he wants. And so again, that's my long-winded answer to your question, which is why are many people sympathetic to socialism? Partly because it's difficult to out these people. You have to do some research to ask them, what are you really proposing? And of course, my major argument, as you know, is that most of what they're proposing is perfect. I won't belabor it any further, but simply state it. Most of what they're proposing, worker-owned companies and co-ops, is perfectly achievable under capitalism if workers really want it. And that, I think, is a key point to make. And they won't resort to that way of doing things because probably they know in their hearts that workers are not ultimately interested in worker co-ops anyway.
Yeah, so I have two follow-ups.
Yeah, sure.
One is the one I want to get to second, but I want to put it out there because I just that we know it's coming is like, okay, you know, a lot of people these days don't debate for socialism directly. They vote for they say modified capitalism.
Well, Bernie,
let me get to that in a minute.
Bernie Sanders likes socialism.
Yeah, yeah, but also like. So I actually think, going from the beginning, you gave that Schumpeter quote, and I think I may have misinterpreted it the first time that I heard it. What was the quote again?
Capitalism stands its trial before judges who have the sentence of death in their pockets.
Okay.
They're going to pass it, whatever defense they hear. The only success, victorious defense can possibly
So he's talking about critics of capitalism.
Yeah.
When I first heard that quote, I thought it was about like, a company, the death is about like a company could go out of business if they don't treat their customers right or something like that.
Well, thank you. So, I didn't realize. He wrote a book. He wrote Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. Yeah. I'm glad I cleared that confusion up. Yeah. No, he's just talking about the critics of capitalism that they are so unreasonable that indeed they just put, as I put it the other night,
they compare it to perfect.
Yeah. They have a criminal trial against capitalism. You're guilty of all these sins. As I said, I want a civil trial. Who gets custody of the economy, capitalism or socialism? And the socialists have to make their case just as much as the capitalists have to about who gets custody. What do you propose? What do you want?
Yeah. Right. I feel like sometimes all human error is attributed to capitalism, whereas it's just it's human error. And the question is, well, which system is going to be more likely have human error over time?
Precisely. You have to, as you indicate, obviously, so much of what we call the evils of capitalism are, of course, simply the evils of social trends, the evils of human beings, the misdeeds of human beings, and so we human beings are going to misbehave. There will be evil in the world. What's the best system for channeling human wishes and incentives into the best outcomes? And clearly, capitalism is by far the best alternative.
So there's also been a lot made about like the role of innovation in capitalist economy versus in a socialist economy. Well, I know Schumpeter had a lot to say about that. What do you say? Yeah. What do you say about, you know, a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are interested in technological innovation, interested in change. What do you see as the argument for innovation, whether it's better under capitalism or what is the role of innovation in the economy? Let's talk about that. Like, why is that important?
When it comes to economic progress, to paraphrase Vince Lombardi about winning being the only thing, innovation is not just one thing, it's the only thing. Innovation is the only thing with respect to achieving economic progress.
So it's not we're running an economy. Maybe every once in a while you come up with an innovation and that's great, but that's not the main thing. You're saying, no, that's the main thing.
It's the only
thing.
Please, it's the only
thing.
Why is it the only thing? It's the only thing because... oddly enough, it was supposed to have been some kind of great intellectual achievement on the part of Nobel Prize winners, Robert Solow is his name, who was the guy who supposedly taught us how important innovation is. And yet, all you have to do is sit under a tree or on a couch and think very simply about this mental experiment. Suppose it's 1750 in America.
Okay.
And we have slow-moving sailing ships and windmills and pot-bellied stoves and certain kinds of agriculture that uses the plow, uses animals. That's the nature of our technology. And now suppose that there is no innovation. There's all the wonderful supply side economic growth that suppliers talk about, plenty of capital investment, and all that's great. but it's capital investment in the same old stuff. Slow-moving sailing ships, oxen-driven plows.
So it might get a few more ox.
A few more oxen, a few more windmills. All of that is great stuff. It's going to help. But where's it going to get us? Obviously, nowhere. If the population increases and overwhelms the land, we might start going hungry. And so clearly the only thing that made for economic progress since 1750 is innovation. Is, of course, obviously ships that were moved not by wind and by sail, but by coal and by oil. All of the innovations that have occurred since 1750. I use 1750 because it's the easiest case, but you could freeze innovation at 1850 in America or 1950.
Yeah.
And when you think about, or indeed, you know, in 1990, when you think about all the things that happened, that have transformed the world and that have made all the difference in terms of enhanced productivity and economic growth. So again, all you have to do is subtract innovation from any moment in history, and then it becomes readily apparent that innovation is not just the main thing, it's the only thing.
So how would it be different if you were debating someone who was saying, well, no, I'm not a socialist. I'm capitalist, sure. But, you know, some things are just not good for capitalism. And, you know, maybe like, you know, certain industries like healthcare need to be socialized. And, you know, there needs to be redistribution. And I think, you know, corporate boards, they have, you know, they represent the shareholders. They're fiduciary to the shareholders. Yeah, that's great. Shareholders are important. But I just think we should broaden it, you know, more. We should have representation for the customers and the employees and the board. So who could be against that? And I feel like that's sort of the argument that you get. And it's kind of a harder one because it feels like do you think it would be harder to argue against someone who is arguing for, say, the mixed economy? Let me put it that way. Like that's what that's what seems to be the mainstream opinion right now.
Well, I guess it would be harder in a way, maybe in a way easier. It would be a very different argument, certainly, because, of course, these people like to insist, I believe that, you know, there should be, you know, private ownership of the means of production. I'm not a socialist. As you say, you certainly can't get them on that issue. You can't get them on the argument that the iron fist of government should control all of the economy.
Right.
You're right about that. But let me...
Because they can credibly say, I'm not going to ban Kickstarter. I believe them.
Well,
whereas the socialist, I don't believe.
Well, that's true, too. Well, look. All of the venture capital, and they're not going to ban that either.
Yeah.
Obviously, Ben Burgess would ban all venture capital, would ban any investment that's going to invest. As I said, Steve Jobs would probably shoot his mouth off before the state-run bank and say, no, I'm going to employ people. What the hell do you think? I'm the one who works 20 hours a week. They all work for me. They would say, get the hell out of here. You're going to go to prison if you try doing that. So, of course, it's absurd to think in those terms with respect to what Ben Burgess wants. But getting to what you just talked about, to begin with, just let's take the last thing that you mentioned, which is how a corporation is run. If it is indeed a corporation, it's not the only alternative.
Sure.
It gets back to my particular hobby horse that we tend to confuse capitalism with the manifestations of capitalism that we find at any one time. It is true that the conventional corporate model that represents the shareholders tends to be the dominant mode in the economy that we do have. Oh, except of course the small businesses and single proprietorships and even co-ops are very common as well. And so even that doesn't capture capitalism specifically. But the point about defining capitalism is to say that all it consists of is operating in free markets with private property in the means of production being protected by law, the right to private property in the means of production being protected by law. It says absolutely nothing about how firms are structured, or indeed whether we even have firms. We might have just individuals just transacting with each other and subcontracting out different things.
Yeah, or and it probably changes based on where what innovations come out. Certain types of firms might make more sense, certain types might make less sense.
Precisely, and as I say, even if we do have firms, we have many more independent contractors than we did. And on top of that, of course, to get back to my hobby horse about what Ben Burgess wants, they could be worker co-ops. So therefore, capitalism says nothing about the structure. So therefore, if to take the easiest case that you just cited, if you're proposing a corporation that has equal representation of the people from the neighborhood and the workers and whoever else, make sure the Jews and the gypsies are also represented on the board, whatever you want, let 100 flowers bloom. If you think that model works best, put together a company that works that way, and it'll be a showcase. It will inspire others to do the same damn thing. Capitalism is a series of trials and errors, unlike socialism. If it fails, then it'll be maybe a worthy experiment to show that it wasn't such a good idea. If it succeeds, then maybe it was. And so clearly, I have no direct opinion about that, except, of course, I do have the subjective view, subject to experiment, that it's probably best that that we have the kind of management situation that we do have, where the managers in charge usually have a fair amount of stock in the corporation, and so they have a very direct stake in its success.
John well, Mackey, I have stock as an employee.
Yeah, so, yeah. So you have some stake in the success, but those who own the corporation have often a more direct stake. We right. could get into arguments about the supposed separation between ownership and control, which is a right. very old argument. That's
so I have a little ownership. I have zero control other than if I'm working there, I have access to management. I could talk to them.
You do, and aside from that, you have hopefully what most workers do have, which is the right to quit. The right to take your business elsewhere. If they don't please you, if they don't pay you enough, if they abuse you, then you might start looking for another job. And if you run an organization, you're often fearful of losing some of your best people, so you want to stay on their good side. That people who work for a company often don't recognize that they are being accommodated in certain ways because they don't want you to quit. They don't want you to leave. And so that so but getting back to the point, and I want to take you set up a framework. Like you said, medical care. I forgot what else.
The usual suspects. The libertarian answer is always like people say the roads need to be socialized. There's so many road
who'll
socialists
the roads?
Out there.
it's practically a joke now. Who'll build the roads?
Yeah.
Well, obviously. Because we could go over a lot of that. I mentioned.
It doesn't sound that scary having government run the roads. I think it would be better if they didn't. But that's a whole.
No, indeed. I mean, you remind me of my argument that I would rather, we have the government basically running the money supply. As I jokingly put it, if it was a forced trade-off, I'd rather that they dominate the shoe industry. Stay away from money, but I'll give you shoes.
Yeah.
Because the shoes will pinch, but we can make sandals in our basements. They would really ruin the shoe industry, but at least they won't do that much harm to our feet. We could protect our feet from them.
Give them hats.
What was that?
Better yet, give them hats.
Yeah, yeah.
Because my feet can get a little. They could hurt if I don't have good shoes.
If they give them the roads, they'll mismanage the roads in all kinds of obvious ways. There'll be potholes in the roads, there'll be roads to nowhere. There'll be crazy ways they price the roads, which create needless traffic jams. But better that we give them the roads than that we give them the money supply, because that's where they really do harm. But the point then is that I thought you wanted me to address some of these arguments. I addressed one of them, of course, having to do with this idea of experimenting with how we manage corporations. And again, it's so little understood, apparently, that that the mode of capitalism we have now is not necessarily the only way to go. If there's a better way to go, trial and error and innovation and good ideas will find the way for us, because if those people do well, others will imitate them. And so capitalism is a far more flexible arrangement than people imagine. And I guess part of the inflexibility, of course, has to do with the crony capitalist system, where the corporations that succeed often tend to dominate government and achieve monopoly positions for themselves. And so that tends to produce stagnation and stasis. But capitalism is a constantly dynamic system that experiments with new ideas all the time.
Yeah. Right. So let me see if I get this. So if you're talking about, there are so many modes of corporate governance we can do, that is a form of innovation on the market.
Oh, yes.
And just like corporate culture is, it's a form of, like, it's an intangible that companies have, and you can experiment and do better. But when you have a law, let's say the federal government passes a law, all the boards have to have these types of people on it. That's obviously more of a problem.
Absolutely. And then, of course, you remind me of the age-old argument about the government giving the corporate structure the right to limited liability. We have the government, in certain cases, possibly mandating certain structures that corporations have to adhere to. And as you indicated, the idea of mandating it seems like a bad idea on its face. It's intrusive, and it may not allow for creativity and experimentation. Let the corporations structure themselves the way they want to, and if investors like it, the investors will invest in it. If they don't like it, the corporation won't get any money. If investors like it and it fails, it will become a showcase for failure. And so experimentation is important to innovation. As you innovators like you know, success is the product of 1,000 failures. And so we have to keep failing. We have to keep going bankrupt in order to achieve an understanding of how success works. So all of that is true. But now we have had for a long time something that Ben Burgess, the socialist, thinks is terrible, and some libertarians often dislike as well, which is that the government allows a corporation to set up a legal system of limited liability. And of course, it's a good idea, because, and it has indeed led to constructive investment, because if you and I are going to invest in a company, we don't want to have unlimited liability for everything that it does, because clearly we don't. Clearly, a corporation will have some difficulty attracting investors if they are taking on unlimited liability as part owners in the company. So this has been criticized. I know that Rothbard has actually just specifically defended it, but I'm not even sure I totally like his argument. If you did not, you don't really need, my clincher about this is that you don't really need the government to dictate this. You can get private agreements that say that if I invest in the company accepts, gives me limited liability. That could be a private agreement. There could be insurance companies that, or even if you don't have that, you could have companies that could be in the business of taking on the liability that the investor doesn't take on. There are all kinds of arrangements for that. I mentioned that because, of course, it's been a hot button with respect to corporations. And we can't deny that limited liability is a good idea. The only thing that doesn't seem to be well understood is that there's so many different ways for the market to have worked out a system of limited liability. It doesn't just have to be the government bestowing it upon us. So I just wanted to resolve that particular issue. Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, thank you very much for this interview today. Gene, I just want to end. Are there any last thoughts on what we talked about today? And also, where can people find out more about you and about the Soho Forum?
Well, there are so many last thoughts, so many things I haven't been able to say today.
I would have guessed.
We could go on.
I would be shocked if you said, I'm done now. I don't really.
But
that's about it.
I'll have to censor myself because I don't even know if your listeners have lasted this long with me. I hope they have. I began by saying that if you are a a podcast listener, and of course, the many thousands, the many tens of thousands of people who listen to your podcast clearly are, then you want to put on your list the Soul Forum Debates, the Soul Forum Debates podcast. There you'll find more than 50 debates, and you've sat through reminiscences on my part and Max's about many of these debates. You can listen to them all. They're all accessible. I've done several others that we didn't mention. There are several other really good ones that I recommend, but no time to do that. But leaf through that, leaf through the list of about over 50 debates at the Soul Forum Debates podcast. Also, I want to announce that we are returning to New York City. We've been driven out. We've had Zoom debates that have many of them have been pretty good, but I'm suffering from Zoom fatigue. Well, I'm not going to do another Zoom debate for a while. Maybe not for, hopefully,
maybe not
for
ever.
Well, look, occasionally
you have to.
Look, if you can get, you know, some guy in Moscow to debate some guy in New York and he can't get, you know, maybe we'll do a Zoom debate. Someday we'll do a Zoom debate again, but only someday. We are going to return to New York City because hopefully the city's opened up. That's where I live. It's named after Soho, south of Houston, where Max used to live. And we have a definite planned for October 4th. That will be the neoconservative William Kristol debating the great Scott Horton on foreign policy.
Oh, shoot. I think I bought a ticket for that like years ago.
Well, then, what do you mean, shoot? If you have a ticket, you can come.
Yeah.
If you want to return to New York, you used to live there, Max. You could probably find your way to New York.
Yeah, I can go there.
We'll give you the address. You could probably find the venue. We haven't decided on a venue yet. We didn't even advertise. We just announced it, and we very quickly sold nearly 800 tickets to it.
Wow.
And so we're looking for a pretty large hall in Manhattan to have it. I had to coax Bill Kristol, who's been very nice, and I want to tell everybody, you might not like Bill Kristol for what he stands for, because he is a neocon, almost the father of neocon of foreign policy, but he's been very cooperative and very nice guy, and please do not assassinate his character on Twitter, because I don't want to alienate him. I want him to show up for a nice polite debate on foreign
policy. My audience is not going to do that. They're not going to assassinate character on Twitter.
Well,
I don't know who's listening, but
people have been saying nasty things about it. Please don't. Okay, that's October 4th in New York City. Max, I hope to see you there. I hope to see all your many thousands of listeners there on October 4th New York City. And now I can shut up for good, Max. Thanks for having me.
Gene, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Sure, bye-bye.
All right. Wasn't that a lot of fun? So it was funny that he mentioned that foreign policy debate with Bill Kristol and Scott Horton. That's one of those ones where I kind of want, I kind of have issues with the way both of those people debate. And so I'm hoping they call each other out. This will have all the relevant stuff up on the show notes upcoming in the next few weeks. I'm finally, I think, going to be talking about design. And I'm going to talk to, I'd like to talk to, I'm not going to say who it is because I haven't done the interview yet, but there's someone in my social media who's written a really great book on design, all types of design. Obviously, design is something that we have to do as engineers as well, or at least we have to interface with designers. And so that is going to be a great one, perhaps particularly if you're thinking about stuff more along the lines of like upgrading your professional skills or just thinking about, you know, how to get things done or how the world works. Really interesting stuff. So stay tuned for that. Have a great week, everyone.
That's the show. To support The Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week.
Feel the power.